but at least it has the feel of real people living real lives. Dishes piled up in the kitchen sink, empty plastic bottles, half-read magazines, past their prime potted tulips, a shopping list taped to the fridge, tights hanging over the back of a chair, newspaper on the table open to the TV guide, an ashtray, a thin box of Virginia Slims. For some strange reason, this scene relaxes me. "This is my friend's apartment," she explains. "She used to work with me at a salon in Tokyo, but last year she had to come back to Takamatsu, where she's from. But then she said she wanted to travel to India for a month, and asked me to take care of the place. I'm doing her job while she's gone. She's a hairdresser too. I thought it's a good change of pace to get out of Tokyo for a while. She's one of those new age types, so I doubt she'll be able to pull herself away from India in a month." She has me sit at the dining table and brings me a can of Pepsi from the fridge. No glass, though. Normally, I don't drink colas. Way too sweet and bad for your teeth. But I'm dying of thirst and down the whole can. "You want anything to eat? All I've got is cup noodle, if that'll do." "I'm okay," I tell her. "You look awful. You know that?" I nod. "So what happened?"
"I wish I knew."
"You have no idea what happened. You didn't even know where you were, and it's a long story," she says, pinning down the facts. "But you're definitely in trouble, yes?"
"Definitely," I reply.
"I hope that, at least, sinks in."
Silence.
All the while, she's bathing me in a deep frown. "You don't really have any relatives in Takamatsu, do you? You ran away from home." Again, I nod.
"Once, when I was your age, I ran away from home.
I think I understand what you're going through. That's why I gave you my mobile phone number. I thought it might come in handy."
"I really appreciate it," I say. "I lived in Ichikawa in Chiba. I never got along with my parents and hated school, so I stole some money from my parents and took off, trying to get as far away as I could. I was 16. I got as far as Abashiri, up in Hokkaido. I stopped at a farm I happened to see and asked them to let me work there. I'll do anything, I told them, and I'll work hard. I don't need any pay as long as there's a roof over my head and you feed me. The lady there was nice to me, made me sit down and have some tea. Just wait here, she said. The next thing I knew, a patrol car pulled up outside and the police were hauling me back home. Apparently, this wasn't the first time the lady had been through this sort of thing. The thought hit me hard then that I had to learn a trade, so no matter where I went, I could always find work. So I left high school, went to a trade school, and became a hairdresser. The edges of her mouth rise a bit in a faint smile. A pretty sound approach to things, don't you think? I agree with her.
Would you tell me the whole story from the beginning, she says, pulling out a cigarette and lighting it. I don't think I'm going to get much more sleep tonight, so I might as well hear it all. I explain everything to her, from the time I left home. I leave out the omen part, though. That, I know, I can't tell just anyone.
10. Is it all right, then, if Nakata calls you Kawamura? He repeated the question to the striped brown cat, enunciating his words slowly, making it as easy to understand as he could. This particular cat had said he thought he'd run across Goma, the missing one-year-old tortoiseshell, in this vicinity. But from Nakata's viewpoint, he spoke very strangely. The feeling was mutual, for the cat seemed to be having its own problems following him. Their conversation was at cross-purposes.
"I don't mind at all the tallest of heads."
"Pardon me, but Nakata doesn't understand what you're saying. Forgive me, but I'm not so bright."
"It's a tuna to the very end."
"Are you perhaps saying you'd like to eat a tuna?"
"No, the hand's tied up before."
Nakata never went into these conversations with cats expecting to be able to easily communicate everything. You have to anticipate a few problems when cats and humans try to speak to each other. And there was another factor to consider. Nakata's own basic problems with talking, not just with cats, but also with people.
His easy conversation with Otsuka the previous week was more the exception than the rule, for invariably getting across even a simple message took a great deal of effort. On bad days, it was more like two people on opposite shores of a canal yelling to each other in a high wind. Today was one of those days. He wasn't sure why, but brown striped cats were the hardest to get on the same wavelength with. With black cats, things mostly went well. Communicating with Siamese cats was the easiest of all, but unfortunately there weren't too many stray Siamese wandering the streets, so the chance didn't present itself often. Siamese were mainly kept at home, well taken care of. And for some reason, brown-striped cats made up the bulk of the strays. Even knowing what to expect, Nakata found Kawamura impossible to decipher. He enunciated his words poorly, and Nakata couldn't catch what each one meant, or the connection between them. What the cat said came out sounding more like riddles than sentences. Still, Nakata was infinitely patient and had plenty of time on his hands. He repeated the same question over and over, having the cat repeat his responses. The two of them were seated on a boundary stone marking a small park for children in a residential area. They'd been talking for nearly an hour, going round and round in circles.
"Kawamura is just a name I'll call you. It doesn't mean anything. Nakata gives names to each cat, so it's easy to remember. It won't cause you any problems, I promise you. I'd just like to call you that, if you don't mind."
In response, Kawamura kept muttering something incomprehensible, and since this wasn't likely to stop any time soon, Nakata interrupted, trying to move their talk along by showing Kawamura the photo of Goma once more.
"Mr. Kawamura, this is Goma, the cat that Nakata is looking for. A one-year-old tortoiseshell cat. She's owned by the Koizumis of the Three Chome neighborhood in Nogata, who lost track of her a while ago. Mrs. Koizumi opened a window, and the cat leapt out and ran away. So, once more, I'd like to ask you, have you seen this cat?"
Kawamura gazed at the photograph again and nodded.
"If it's true now, Kawamura tied up, try to find." "I'm sorry, but as I said a moment ago, Nakata is not very bright and can't understand very well what you're getting at. Would you mind repeating that?"
"If it's true now, Kawamura tries, try to find and tied it up."
"By tuna, you mean the fish? Tries the tuna, tie it, Kawamura."
Nakata rubbed his closely cropped salt-and-pepper hair and puzzled this over. What could he possibly do to solve this tuna riddle and escape from the maze the conversation had become? No matter how much he put his mind to it, however, he was clueless. Puzzling things out logically, after all, wasn't exactly his forte. Totally blithe to it all, Kawamura lifted a rear leg and gave the spot just below his chin a good scratch. Just then, Nakata thought he heard a small laugh behind him. He turned and saw, seated on a low concrete wall next to a house, a lovely, slim Siamese looking at him with narrowed eyes.
"Excuse me, but would you by chance be Mr. Nakata?" the Siamese purred.
"Yes, that's correct. My name's Nakata. It's very nice to meet you."
"Likewise, I'm sure," the Siamese replied.
"It's been cloudy since this morning, but I don't expect we'll be seeing any rain soon," Nakata said.
"I do hope the rain holds off."
The Siamese was a female, just approaching middle age. She proudly held her tail up straight and had a collar with the name tag. She had pleasant features and was slim, with not an ounce of surplus fat.
"Please call me Mimi. The Mimi from La Bohème. There's a song about her, too. Mi chiamano Mimi."
"I see,"
Nakata said, not really following.
"An opera by Puccini, you know. My owner happens to be a great fan of opera,"
Mimi said, and smiled amiably.
"I'd sing it for you, but unfortunately I'm not much of a singer."
"Nakata's very happy to meet you, Mimi-san."
"Same for me, Mr. Nakata."
Do you live near here?
Yes, in that two-story house over there. The Tanabe's house. You see it, right? The one with the cream-coloured BMW 530 parked in front.
I see, Nakata repeated. He had no idea what a BMW was, but he did spot a cream-coloured car. That must be what she meant.
Mr. Nakata, Mimi said, I'm known as self-reliant, or perhaps you'd say a very private sort of cat, so I don't normally interfere in others' affairs. But that youngster, the one I believe you're referring to as Kawamura, is not what I would call the brightest kitty in the litter. When he was still young, a child ran into him with his bicycle, the poor thing, and he struck his head against some concrete. Ever since then he hasn't made much sense. So even if you are patient with him, as I see you've been, you won't get anywhere. I've been watching for a while, and I'm afraid I couldn't just sit idly by. I know it's forward of me to do so, but I had to say something.
No, please, don't think that. I'm very happy you told me. Nakata's as dumb as Kawamura, I'm afraid, and can't get by without other people's help. That's why I get a subsidy from the governor every month, so I'm very happy to hear your opinion, Mimi.
I take it you're looking for a cat, Mimi said. I wasn't eavesdropping, mind you, but just happened to overhear you as I was taking a nap here.
Goma, I believe you said the name was?
Yes, that's correct.
And Kawamura has seen Goma?
That's what he told me, but Nakata can't work out what he said after that.
If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Nakata, why don't I step in and try to talk with him? It's easier for two cats to communicate, and I'm fairly used to the way he talks. So why don't I sound him out, then summarize it for you?
That would be very helpful, I'm sure.
The Siamese nodded lightly, and like a ballet dancer, nimbly leapt down from the concrete wall. Black tail held up high like a flagstaff, she walked leisurely over and sat down beside Kawamura. He immediately began to sniff Mimi's rump, but the Siamese gave him a swift blow to the cheek, and the younger cat shrunk back. With barely a pause, Mimi dealt him another blow to the nose.
"Now pay attention, you brainless dingbat, you stinky good-for-nothing," Mimi hissed, then turned to Nakata. "You've got to show him who's in charge straight off, or you'll never get anywhere. Otherwise he'll go all spacey on you, and all you get is drivel. It's not his fault he's this way, and I do feel sorry for him, but what are you to do?"
"I see," Nakata said, not at all sure what he was agreeing to.
The two cats began conversing, but they spoke so quickly and softly that Nakata wasn't able to catch any of it. Mimi grilled Kawamura in a sharp tone, the younger cat replying timidly. Any hesitation got him another merciless slap to the face. This Siamese cat was clever and educated, too. Nakata had met many cats up till this point, but never before one who listened to opera and knew models of cars. Impressed, he watched as Mimi went about her business with a brisk efficiency. Once Mimi had heard everything she wanted to, she chased the younger cat off. "Be on your way," she said sharply, and he slunk dejectedly away. Mimi nestled into Nakata's lap.
"I think I've got the gist of it."
"Much obliged," Nakata said.
"That cat, Kawamura, that is, said he's seen Goma several times in a grassy spot just down the road. It's an empty plot of land they were planning to build on. A property developer bought up a car company's parts warehouse and tore it down, planning to put up a high-class complex. A citizens' movement opposed the development, there was some legal battle, and the construction's been put on hold. The sort of thing that happens all the time these days. The plot's overgrown with grass, and people hardly ever go there, so it's the perfect hangout for all the strays in the neighbourhood. I don't keep company with many cats, and I don't want to get fleas, so I hardly ever go over there. As you're no doubt aware, fleas are like a bad habit, awfully hard to get rid of once you get them.
I see, Nakata said.
He told me the cat's just like the one in the photograph, a timid, pretty young tortoiseshell with a flea collar. Can't seem to speak that well either. It's clear to anyone that it's a naive house cat that can't find its way back home.
When was this, I wonder?
The last time he saw the cat seems to have been 3 or 4 days ago. As he's not very bright, he's not even sure about days. But he did say it was the day after it rained, so I'm thinking it must have been Monday. I seem to recall it rained pretty hard on Sunday. Nakata doesn't know about the days of the week, but I think it did rain around then. He hasn't seen her since.
That was the last time. The other cats haven't seen her either, he says. He's a spacey, good-for-nothing cat, but I pressed him closely and believe most of what he says.
I really want to thank you. No need. It was my pleasure.
Most of the time I have only this worthless bunch of cats around here to talk to, and we never seem to agree on anything.
I find it incredibly irritating. So it's a breath of fresh air to be able to talk to a sensible human such as yourself.
I see, Nakata said. There's one thing Nakata still doesn't understand. Mr. Kawamura kept going on about tuna, and I was wondering if he meant the fish.
Mimi lithely lifted her left front leg, inspecting the pink flesh of the pad, and chuckled.
The youngster's terminology isn't very extensive, I'm afraid.
Terminology?
The number of words he's familiar with is limited, is what I'm saying. So for him, everything that's good to eat is tuna. For him, tuna's the creme de la creme as far as food goes. He doesn't know there are such things as sea bream, halibut, or yellowtail.
Nakata cleared his throat.
Actually, Nakata's very fond of tuna. Of course, I like eel as well.
I'm fond of eel myself, though it's not the sort of thing you can eat all the time.
That's true. You couldn't eat it all the time.
The two of them were silent for a time, eel musings filling the passing moments.
Anyway, what that cat was getting at is this, Mimi said, as if suddenly remembering. Not long after the neighborhood cats began hanging out at that vacant plot, a bad person showed up who catches cats. The other cats believe that this man may have taken Goma away. The man lures them with something good to eat, then throws them into a large sack. The man's quite skilled at catching cats, and a hungry, innocent cat like Goma would easily fall into his trap. Even the stray cats who live around here, normally a wary bunch, have lost a couple of their number to this man. It's simply hideous, because nothing could be worse for a cat than to be stuffed inside a bag.
I see, Nakata said, and again rubbed his salt and pepper hair with his palm. But what does this man do with the cats once he's caught them?
That I don't know. In the old days they used to make shamisens out of catskin, but nowadays not too many people play the shamisen. And besides, I hear they mainly use plastic now. In some parts of the world, people eat cats, though not in Japan, thank goodness. So I think we can exclude both of these as motives. Which leaves, let me see, people who use cats in scientific experiments.
Cats are used a lot in experiments. One of my friends, in fact, was used in a psychological experiment at Tokyo University. A terrible thing, but it's a long story and I won't go into it now.
There are also perverts, not many, mind you, who simply enjoy tormenting cats, catching a cat and chopping off its tail, for instance.
What do they do after they chop it off?
Nothing. They just want to torment and hurt the cats. Makes them feel good for some reason. I'm afraid there are twisted people like that in the world.
Nakata gave this some thought. How could chopping off a cat's tail possibly be fun?
So what you're saying is that maybe this twisted person has taken Goma away? He asked.
Mimi screwed up her long white whiskers and frowned.
I'd rather not think that, or even imagine it, but it is a possibility. Mr. Nakata, I haven't lived all that many years, but I've seen terrible things I never could have imagined. Most people look at cats and think, what a life. All we do is lie around in the sun, never having to lift a finger. But cats' lives aren't that idyllic. Cats are powerless, weak little creatures that injure easily. We don't have shells like turtles, nor wings like birds. We can't burrow into the ground like moles or change colour like a chameleon. The world has no idea how many cats are injured every day, how many of us meet a miserable end. I happen to be lucky enough to live with the Tanabes in a warm and friendly family. The children treat me well, and I've got everything I need. But even my life isn't always easy. When it comes to strays, though, they have a very tough time of it.
You're really clever, aren't you, Mimi?
Nakata said, impressed by the Siamese's eloquence.
No, not really, Mimi replied, narrowing her eyes in embarrassment. I just spend too much time lying in front of the TV, and this is what happens. My head gets full of worthless facts. Do you ever watch TV, Mr. Nakata?
No, Nakata doesn't watch TV. The people on TV talk too fast, and I can't keep up with them. I'm dumb, so I can't read, and if you can't read, TV doesn't make much sense. Sometimes I listen to the radio, but the words there are also too fast, and it tires me out. I much prefer doing this, enjoying talking to a cat outside, under the sky.
Indeed, Mimi said.
That's right, Nakata said.
I really hope that Goma is all right.
Mimi, Nakata's going to have a look at that empty plot of land.
According to the youngster, this man is very tall, wears a strange tall hat and long leather boots, and he walks fast. He looks very unusual, so you'll recognize him right away, he told me. Whenever the cats that gather at the empty plot see him coming, they scatter in all directions. But a newcomer might not know enough to...
Nakata stored this information away in his head, carefully folding it all away in a front drawer so he wouldn't forget it. The man is very tall, wears a strange tall hat, and long leather boots.
I hope I've been of help, Mimi said.
Nakata appreciates everything you've done. If you hadn't been kind enough to speak up, I'd still be going round and round about tuna. I'm grateful.
What I think, Mimi said, gazing up at Nakata with knitted brows, is that this man is trouble. A lot of trouble. He's more dangerous than you can ever imagine. If it were me, I'd never go near that plot. But you're a human, and it's your job, after all. But I hope you'll take every precaution.
Thank you very kindly. I'll be as careful as I can.
Mr. Nakata, this world is a terribly violent place, and nobody can escape the violence. Please keep that in mind. You can't be too cautious. The same holds true for cats as for human beings.
I remember that, Nakata replied.
But he had no idea where and how the world could be violent.
The world was full of things Nakata couldn't comprehend, and most things connected with violence fell into that category.
After saying goodbye to Mimi, he went to see the empty plot, which turned out to be about the size of a small playground. A tall plywood fence enclosed the area, with a sign on it saying, "Keep out, site of future construction," which Nakata naturally couldn't read. A heavy chain blocked the entrance, but round the back was a gap in the fence, and he easily got inside. Someone must have prized it open. All the warehouses that had originally stood there had been torn down, but the land hadn't been levelled for building on, and was covered with grass. Goldenrod grew as high as a child, a couple of butterflies flickering above it. Mounds of earth had hardened in the rain, in some places rising up in little hillocks. A perfect place for cats. People wouldn't come in, there were all sorts of little creatures to catch, and plenty of places to hide. Kawamura was nowhere to be seen. Two scrawny cats with rough coats were there, but when Nakata called out a friendly greeting, they glanced at him coldly and disappeared into the weeds. Which made sense. None of them wanted to get caught and have his tail chopped off. Nakata himself certainly didn't want to have that happen to him, not that he had a tail. It was no wonder the cats were wary of him. Nakata stood on higher ground and took a good look around. No one else was there, only the butterflies searching for something fluttering above the weeds. He found a good spot to sit down, lowered his canvas bag from his shoulder, took out two bean jam buns, and had his usual lunch. He drank hot tea from a thermos, eyes narrowed as he sipped. Just a quiet, early afternoon. Everything was at rest, placid, harmonious. Nakata found it hard to believe that somebody might be lying in wait to torment and torture cats. He rubbed his hair as he chewed. If somebody else were with him, he could explain. Nakata's not very bright. But unfortunately, he was alone. All he could do was nod a few times to himself and continue chewing. Once he finished the buns, he folded up the cellophane they'd been wrapped in into a compact square and put it in his bag. He screwed the lid back tight on the thermos and put it in his bag as well. The sky was covered with a layer of clouds, but from their colour he could tell that the sun was just about directly overhead.
"The man is very tall, wears a strange tall hat and long leather boots." Nakata tried to picture this man, but had no idea what a strange tall hat or long leather boots looked like. In his whole life he'd never encountered any tall hats and long leather boots.
Kawamura had told Mimi that you'd know him when you saw him. So, Nakata decided,
I suppose I'll just have to wait until I see him. That's definitely the best plan.
He stood up and relieved himself in the weeds, a long, honest pee, then went over to a clump of weeds in a corner of the vacant plot of land, where he had the best chance of remaining hidden from sight, and sat out the rest of the afternoon, waiting for that strange man to turn up. Waiting was a boring task. He had no idea when the man might next appear. Maybe tomorrow, maybe not for a week. Or maybe he'll never show up again. There was that possibility. Nakata, though, was used to aimless waiting and spending time alone, doing nothing. He wasn't bothered in the least. Time wasn't the main issue for him. He didn't even own a watch. Nakata operated on his own sense of time. In the morning it got light, in the evening the sun set, and it got dark. Once it got dark, he'd go to the nearby public baths, and after coming home from his bath, he'd go to sleep. The public baths were closed on certain days of the week, and when that happened, he'd just give up and go straight home. His stomach told him when it was time to eat, and when the time came for him to go and pick up his sub-city, somebody was always nice enough to tell him when that day was near, he knew another month had passed. The next day he'd always go for a haircut at the local barber shop. Every summer, someone from the ward office would treat him to eel, and every new year they'd bring him rice cakes. Nakata let his body relax, switched off his mind, letting things flow through him. This was natural for him, something he'd done ever since he was a child, without a second thought. Before long, the borders of his consciousness fluttered around, just like the butterflies. Beyond these borders lay a dark abyss. Occasionally his consciousness would fly over the border and hover over that dizzying black crevasse. But Nakata wasn't afraid of the darkness, or how deep it was. And why should he be? That bottomless world of darkness, that weighty silence and chaos, was an old friend, a part of him already. Nakata understood this well. In that world there was no writing, no days of the week, no scary governor, no opera, no BMWs, no scissors, no tall hats. On the other hand, neither were there delicious eel, no tasty bean jam buns. Everything is there, but there are no parts. Since there are no parts, there's no need to replace one thing with another. No need to remove anything or add anything. You don't have to think about difficult things. Just let yourself soak it all in. For Nakata, nothing could be better. Occasionally he dozed off. When he slept, though, his senses, ever vigilant, kept watch over the vacant plot. If something happened, if somebody came, he could wake up and do what needed to be done. The sky was covered with a flat line of grey clouds, but at least it wasn't going to rain. The cats all knew it, and so did Nakata.
11. When I've finished talking, it's pretty late. Sakura listens intently the whole time, resting her head in her hands on the kitchen table. I tell her that I'm actually 15, in junior high, that I stole my father's money and ran away from my home in Nakano Ward in Tokyo, that I'm staying in a hotel in Takamatsu and spending my days reading at a library, that all of a sudden I found myself collapsed outside a shrine, covered with blood. Everything. Well, almost everything. Not the important stuff I can't talk about. So your mother left home with your older sister when you were only 4, leaving you and your father behind. I take the photo of my sister and me at the shore from my wallet and show her. "This is my sister," I say. Sakura looks at the photo for a while, and hands it back without a word. I haven't seen her since then, I say. Or my mum. She's never been in touch, and I have no idea where she is. I don't even remember what she looks like. There aren't any photos of her left. I remember her smell, her touch, but not her face. Hmm, Sakura says. Head in her hand still, she narrows her eyes and looks at me. Must have been hard on you. Yeah, I guess. She continues to gaze at me silently. So you didn't get along with your dad? She asks after a while. Didn't get along? How am I supposed to answer that? I don't say anything. Just shake my head. Silly question. Of course you didn't. Otherwise you wouldn't have run away, Sakura says. So anyway, you left your home, and today you suddenly lost consciousness or your memory or something. Yeah. Did that ever happen before? Sometimes, I tell her honestly. I fly into a rage, and it's as if I blow a fuse, as if somebody pushes a switch in my head, and my body does its thing before my mind can catch up. It's as if I'm here, but in a way it's not me. You lose control and do something violent, you mean? It's happened a few times, yeah. Have you hurt anybody? I nod. Twice I did. Nothing serious. She thinks about this. Is that what happened this time? I shake my head. This is the first time something this bad's happened. This time. I don't know how it started, and I can't remember what happened at all. It's as if my memory was wiped clean. It never was this bad before. She looks at the t-shirt I pull out of my backpack, carefully checking the stain of blood I couldn't wash out. So the last thing you remember is eating dinner, right? At a restaurant near the station. I nod. And everything after that's a blank. The next thing you knew, you were lying in the bushes behind that shrine, about 4 hours later, your shirt covered in blood and your left shoulder aching. I give her another nod. She brings over a city map from somewhere and checks the distance between the station and the shrine. It's not so far, but it would take a while to walk. But why would you have been over there in the first place? It's the opposite direction from your hotel. Have you ever gone there before? Never. Take off your shirt for a minute, she says. I strip to the waist, and she walks behind me and grabs my left shoulder. Her fingers dig into my flesh, and I can't help but gasp. This girl's pretty strong. Does it hurt? Damn right it does, I say. You hit something pretty hard, or something hit you. I don't remember a thing. Anyway, nothing's broken, she says. She proceeds to prod around the sore spot, and aside from the pain, her fingers feel really nice. When I tell her so, she smiles. I've always been good at giving massages. It's a useful skill for a hairdresser. She keeps on massaging my shoulder. Doesn't look like anything major. Give it a good night's sleep, and you should feel better. She picks up my t-shirt, puts it in a plastic bag, and tosses it in the bin. My checked shirt she gives a once-over and throws in the washing machine. She rummages around in a chest of drawers and comes up with a white t-shirt she hands me, a brand new shirt that says Maui Whale Watching Cruise on it, with a picture of a whale's tail sticking out of the water. This is the biggest shirt I could find. It's not mine, but don't worry about it. It's just a souvenir from somebody. Might not be your style, but give it a try. I tug the shirt on, which fits perfectly. You can keep it if you want, she says. I thank her. So you never had such a total memory loss before? She asks. I nod, then close my eyes, feeling the t-shirt, taking in its new smell. Sakura, I'm really frightened, I tell her. I don't know what to do. I don't have any memory of hurting anybody. Whatever it was covered me in blood, but I can't remember anything. If I committed a crime, I'm still legally responsible, right, whether I have a memory of it or not. Maybe it was just a nosebleed. Somebody was walking down the street, bumped into a telephone pole and got a bloody nose. And all you did was help them out. See? I understand why you're worried. But let's try not to think about worst-case scenarios, okay? At least not tonight. In the morning, we can look in the paper, watch the news on TV. If something terrible really happened, we'll know about it. Then we can consider our options. There are plenty of reasons why someone might get blood on them, and most of the time it's not nearly as bad as it looks. I'm a girl, so I'm used to seeing blood. I see that much every month, you know what I mean? I nod, and feel myself blushing a little. She scoops a little Nescafe into a big cup, and heats some water in a small pan. She smokes, waiting for the water to boil. She takes a couple of puffs, then extinguishes the cigarette with tap water. I catch a whiff of menthol. I don't mean to pry, but there's something I want to ask you. Do you mind? I don't mind, I tell her. Your older sister was adopted. They got her from somewhere before you were born, right? That's right, I reply. I don't know why, but my parents adopted her. After that, I was born. Not exactly what they had in mind, I imagine. So you're definitely the child of your mother and father. As far as I know, I tell her. But when your mother left, she didn't take you, but took your sister, who's unrelated to her, Sakura says. Not what you'd normally expect a woman to do. I don't say anything. Why'd she do that? I shake my head. I have no idea, I tell her. I've asked myself the same question a million times. That must have hurt. Did it? I don't know, but if I get married someday, I don't think I'll have any kids. I wouldn't have any idea how to get along with them if I did. My situation wasn't as complicated as yours, she says. But I didn't get along with my parents for a long time, and I got mixed up in a lot of stupid things because of it. So I know how you feel. But it's not a good idea to make decisions so soon. There's no such thing as absolutes. She stands in front of the kitchen stove and sips her Nescafe, steam rising from the large cup. The cup has a drawing of the Moomin cartoon characters on it. She doesn't say anything, and neither do I. Do you have anybody, relatives or someone who can help? She asks after a while. No, I say. My father's parents died a long time ago, and he doesn't have any brothers, sisters, uncles or aunts. Not one. Not that I can prove this, but I do know he never had anything to do with any relatives. And I never heard anything about relatives on my mother's side. I mean, I don't even know my mother's name, so how was I supposed to know about her relatives? Your father sounds like an alien from outer space or something, Sakura says. Like he came from some far-off planet, took on human form, kidnapped an Earth woman, and then had you. Just so he could have more descendants. Your mother found out, got frightened, and ran away. Like in some film noir science fiction flick. I have no idea what to say. Joking aside, she says, and smiles broadly to show that she means it. My point is, in this whole wide world, the only person you can depend on is you. I guess so. She stands there leaning against the sink, drinking her coffee. I have to get some sleep, she says, as if suddenly remembering. It's past 3. I have to get up at 7:30, so I won't get much, but a little's better than none. I hate going to work on no sleep at all. So what are you going to do? I have my sleeping bag with me, I tell her, so if it's no bother, I'll just crash out in a corner. I take my tightly rolled up sleeping bag out of my backpack, spread it out and fluff it up. She watches impressed. A regular Boy Scout, she says. After she turns out the light and gets into bed, I climb into my sleeping bag, shut my eyes and try to go to sleep. But I can't stop picturing that blood-stained white T-shirt. I still feel that burning sensation in my palm. I open my eyes and stare at the ceiling. The floor creaks somewhere. Somebody turns on a tap. And again I hear an ambulance in the night, far off but echoing sharply in the darkness. Can't fall asleep, she whispers in the dark. No, I say. Me neither. Shouldn't have had that coffee, that was dumb. She switches on her bedside light, checks the time, then turns the light off. Don't get me wrong, she says. But if you'd like to come over here, you can. I can't sleep either. I slip out of my sleeping bag and climb into bed with her. I'm wearing boxers and the T-shirt. She has on a pair of light pink pajamas. I have a steady boyfriend in Tokyo, she tells me. He's not much to brag about, but he's my guy. So I don't have sex with anybody else. I might not look like it, but when it comes to sex, I'm pretty straight-laced. Call me old-fashioned, but I wasn't always that way. I used to be pretty wild, but I don't fool around anymore. So don't get any ideas, okay? Just think of us as brother and sister. Understand? Gotcha, I tell her. She puts her arms around me, hugs me close and rests her cheek on my forehead. You poor thing, she says. I don't need to tell you that I get a hard-on right away. Big time. And it couldn't help rubbing up against her thigh. My, oh my, she says. Sorry, I tell her. I didn't mean to. It's okay, she says. I know what an inconvenience it is. Nothing you can do to stop it. I nod in the darkness. She hesitates for a moment, then lowers my boxers, pulls out my rock-hard cock and cradles it gently in her hand. As if she's making sure of something, the way a doctor takes a pulse. With her soft hand touching me, I feel something, a stray thought maybe, spring up in my crutch. How old would your sister be now? 21, I say. 6 years older than me. She thinks about this for a while. Do you want to see her? Maybe, I say. Maybe? Her hand grasps my cock a little harder. What do you mean, maybe? You really don't want to see her that much. I don't know what we'd talk about, and she might not want to see me. Same thing with my mother. Maybe neither one of them wants to have anything to do with me. No one's searching for me. I mean, they left and everything. Without me, I complete the thought. She doesn't say anything. Her hand on my cock loosens a bit, then tightens. In time with this, my cock relaxes, then gets even harder. You want to come? She asks. Maybe, I say. Again with the maybes. Very much, I correct myself. She sighs lightly, and slowly begins to move her hand. It feels out of this world. Not just an up-and-down motion, but more of an all-over massage. Her fingers gently stroke my cock and my balls. I close my eyes and let out a big sigh. You can't touch me, and when you're about to come, let me know so you don't mess up the sheets. Okay, I say. How is it? I'm pretty good, huh? Fantastic. As I was telling you, I'm very nimble-fingered. But this isn't sex, okay? I'm just helping you relax is what it is. You've had a rough day, you're all tense, and you're not going to sleep well unless we do something about it. Got it? Yeah, I get it, I say. But I do have one request. What's that? Is it okay if I imagine you naked? Her hand stops, and she looks me in the eye. You want to imagine me naked while we're doing this? Yeah. I've been trying to keep from imagining that, but I can't. Really? It's like a TV you can't turn off. She laughs. I don't get it. You didn't have to tell me that. Why don't you just go ahead and imagine what you want? You don't need my permission. How can I know what's in your head? I can't help it. Imagining something's very important, so I thought I'd better tell you. It has nothing to do with whether you know or not. You are some kind of polite boy, aren't you? She says, impressed. I guess it's nice, though, that you wanted to let me know. All right. Permission granted. Go ahead and picture me nude. Thanks, I say. How is it? Is my body nice? It's amazing, I reply. This languid sensation spreads over my lower half, like a liquid floating to the surface. When I tell her, she grabs some tissues from the bedside, and I come. Over and over like crazy. A little while later, she goes to the kitchen, tosses away the tissues, and rinses her hand. Sorry, I say. It's all right, she says, snuggling back into bed. No need to apologize. It's just a part of your body. So, do you feel better? Definitely. I'm glad. She thinks for a while, then says, I was thinking how nice it'd be if I was your real sister. Me too, I say. She lightly touches my hair. I'm going to sleep now, so why don't you go back to your sleeping bag? I can't sleep well unless I'm alone, and I don't want your hard on poking me all night, okay? I go back to my sleeping bag and close my eyes. This time, I can sleep. A deep, deep sleep. Maybe the deepest since I ran away from home. It's as if I'm in some huge lift that slowly, silently carries me deeper and deeper underground. Finally, all light has disappeared. All sound faded away. When I wake up, Sakura's left for work. It's 9 a.m. My shoulder hardly aches at all anymore. Just as she said. On the kitchen table, I find a morning paper, a note, and a key. Her note says, I watched the TV news at 7 and looked all through the paper, but there weren't any bloody incidents reported around here. So I don't think that blood was anything. Good news, eh? There isn't much in the fridge, but help yourself and make use of whatever you need around the house. If you aren't planning to go anywhere, feel free to hang out here. Just put the key under the doormat if you go out. I take a carton of milk from the fridge, check the expiry date, and pour it over some cornflakes, boil some water, and make a cup of Darjeeling tea. Toast 2 slices of bread and eat them with low-fat margarine. Then I open the newspaper and scan the local news. As she said, no violent crimes in the headlines. I let out a sigh of relief, fold up the paper and put it back where it was. At least I won't have to run all over the city trying to evade the police. But I decide it's better not to go back to the hotel, just to play it safe. I still don't know what happened during those lost 4 hours. I call the hotel. A man answers, and I don't recognize his voice. I tell him something's come up and I have to check out. I try my best to sound grown up. I've paid in advance, so it shouldn't be a problem. There are some personal effects in the room, I tell him, but they can be discarded. He checks the computer and sees that the bill's up to date. Everything's in order, Mr. Tamura, he says. You're all checked out. The key's a plastic card, so there's no need to return it. I thank him and hang up. I take a shower. Sakura's underwear and tights are drying in the bathroom. I try not to look at them and concentrate on my usual job of thoroughly scrubbing myself. And I try my best not to think about last night. I brush my teeth and put on a clean pair of pants, roll up my sleeping bag and stuff it into my backpack. Then wash my dirty clothes in the washing machine. There's no dryer, so after they go through the wringer, I fold them up and put them in a plastic bag and into my pack. I can always dry them at a laundrette later on. I wash all the dishes piled up in the sink, let them drain, dry them, and put them back on the shelf. Then I straighten up the contents of the fridge and toss out whatever's gone bad. Some of the food stinks. Moldy broccoli, an ancient rubbery cucumber, a packet of tofu, well past its expiry date. I take whatever's still edible, transfer it into new containers, and wipe up some spilled sauce. I throw out all the cigarette butts, make a neat stack of the scattered old newspapers, and run a hoover around the place. Sakura might be good at giving a massage, but when it comes to keeping house, she's a disaster. I iron the shirts she's crammed in the chest of drawers, and think about going shopping and making dinner. At home, I try to take care of household chores myself, so none of this is any trouble. But making dinner, I decide, might be going too far. Finished with all that, I sit at the kitchen table and look around the apartment. I know I can't stay here forever. I'd have a semi-permanent hard-on with semi-permanent fantasies. Can't avoid looking at those tiny black panties hanging in the bathroom. Can't keep asking her permission to let my imagination roam. But most of all, I can't forget what she did for me last night. I leave a note for Sakura, using the blunt pencil and the memo pad beside the phone. Thanks. You really saved me. I'm sorry I woke you up so late last night. But you're the only one I could count on. I stop for a moment to think what I should write next, and do a 360 of the room as I'm thinking. Thanks for letting me stay over. I'm grateful you said I could stay here as long as I liked. It would be nice if I could, but I don't think I should bother you anymore. There are all sorts of reasons I won't go into. I've got to make it on my own. I hope you'll still think kindly of me the next time I'm in a jam. I stop again. Someone in the neighborhood's got their TV on at full volume, one of those morning talk shows for housewives. The people on the show all yelling at each other, and commercials just as loud and obnoxious. I sit at the table, spinning the blunt pencil in my hand, pulling my thoughts together. To tell you the truth, though, I don't think I deserve your kindness. I'm trying my best to be a much better person, but things aren't going so well. The next time we meet, I hope I'll have my act together. Whether that will happen or not, I don't know. Thanks for last night. It was wonderful. I slip the note under a cup, shoulder my backpack, and head out of the apartment, leaving the key under the doormat as she told me. A black and white spotted cat's lying in the middle of the stairs, taking a nap. It must be used to people, because it doesn't make a move to get up as I go down the stairs. I sit down beside it and stroke his large body for a while. The feel of his fur brings back memories. The cat narrows his eyes and starts to purr. We sit there on the stairs for a long time, each enjoying his own version of this intimate feeling. Eventually, I tell him goodbye and walk down the road. A fine rain's begun to fall. Having checked out of the hotel and left Sakura's, I have no idea where I'll spend the night. Before the sun sets, I've got to find a roof to sleep under, somewhere safe. I don't know where to begin, but I decide to take the train out to the Komura Library. Once I get there, something will work out. I don't know why, but I just have a feeling it will. Fate seems to be taking me in some even stranger directions.
12. October the 19th, 1972. Dear Professor, I'm sure you'll be quite surprised to receive a letter from me out of the blue. Please forgive me for being so forward. I imagine that you no longer remember my name, Professor, but I was, at one time, a teacher at a small elementary school in Yamanashi Prefecture. When you read this, you may recall something about me. I was the teacher in charge of the group of children on a field trip, the ones involved in the incident in which the children all lost consciousness. Afterwards, as you may remember, I had the opportunity to speak with you and your colleagues from the university in Tokyo several times when you visited our town with people from the military to investigate. In the years following, I've often seen your name mentioned prominently in the press and have followed your career and achievements with the deepest admiration. At the same time, I have fond memories of when we met, especially your very businesslike, brisk way of speaking. I feel blessed, too, to have been able to read several of your books. I've always been impressed by your insights, and I find the world view that runs through all of your publications very convincing, namely that as individuals, each of us is extremely isolated, while at the same time we are all linked by a prototypical memory. There have been times in my own life that I felt exactly this way. From afar, then, I pray for your continued success. After that incident, I continued to teach at the same elementary school. A few years ago, however, I unexpectedly fell ill, was hospitalized for a long spell at Kofu General Hospital, and after some time, resigned from my job. For a year I was in and out of the hospital, but eventually I recovered, was discharged, and opened a small tutorial school in our town. My students were the children of my former pupils. It's a trite observation, perhaps, but it is true what they say, that time does fly, and I have found the passage of time to be incredibly swift. During the war, I lost both my husband and father, then my mother as well, in the confused period following the surrender. With my husband off to war soon after we married, we never had any children, so I've been all alone in the world. I wouldn't say my life has been happy, but it has been a great blessing to have been able to teach for so long and have the chance to work with so many children over the years. I thank God for this opportunity. If it hadn't been for teaching, I don't think I'd have been able to survive. I summoned up my courage today to write to you, Professor, because I've never been able to forget that incident in the woods in the autumn of 1944. 28 years have passed, but to me it's as fresh in my mind as if it took place yesterday. Those memories are always with me, shadowing my every waking moment. I've spent countless sleepless nights pondering it all, and it's even haunted my dreams. It's as if the aftershocks of that incident affect every aspect of my life. To give you an example, whenever I run across any of the children involved in the incident, half of whom still live here in town and are now in their mid-30s, I always wonder what effects the incident had on them, and on myself. Something as traumatic as that you'd think would have to have had some lingering physical or psychological impact on all of us. I can't believe otherwise. But when it comes to pinpointing what sort of effects these were, and how great an impact it all had, I'm at a loss. As you're well aware, Professor, the military kept news of this incident from reaching the public. During the occupation, the American military conducted their own investigation behind closed doors. The military's always the same, whether Japanese or American. Even when censorship was lifted after the occupation, no articles about the incident appeared in newspapers or magazines, which I suppose is understandable, since it had taken place years before and no one had died. Because of this, most people are unaware that such an incident ever took place. During the war, there were so many horrific events, and millions of people lost their lives, so I don't suppose people would be very shocked by what happened in our little town. Even here, not many people remember what happened, and those who do don't appear willing to talk about it. I'd say most people who recall the incident find it an unpleasant memory they'd prefer not to touch on. Most things are forgotten over time. Even the war itself, the life and death struggle people went through, is now like something from the distant past. We're so caught up in our everyday lives that events of the past, like ancient stars that have burned out, are no longer in orbit about our minds. There are just too many things we have to think about every day, too many new things we have to learn, new styles, new information, new technology, new terminology. But still, no matter how much time passes, no matter what takes place in the interim, there are some things we can never assign to oblivion. Memories we can never rub away. They remain with us forever, like a touchstone. And for me, what happened in the woods that day is one of these. I realize there's nothing I can do about it now, and I would certainly understand if you are puzzled as to why I'm bringing it up at this late date. But while I'm still alive, there's something I have to get off my chest. During the war, of course, we lived under strict censorship, and there were things we couldn't easily talk about. When I met you, Professor, there were military officers also with us, and I couldn't speak freely. Also, I didn't know anything about you then, or about your work, so I certainly didn't feel, as a young woman talking to a man she didn't know, I could be candid about any private matter. Thus, I kept several facts to myself. In other words, In the official investigation, I intentionally changed some of the facts about the incident. And when, after the war, the American military interviewed me,